Good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to see you all. Good to be here. So it's been a few months since I've given a talk. November was the last time I gave one. And I appreciate, you know, the space and the opportunity to set it down for a while, and I appreciate somebody checking in to say, so, you want to do it again or what? And I enter both, I think, with the same amount of wonder and curiosity. Moving forward, well, that will just be what it is. But back in November, around that time of putting it down, I didn't really know why. There wasn't a clear reason that I was saying, I need to do this because of. I just noticed, something wants to put this down. And actually, I was putting my schedule on my website, you know, a couple months in advance, and realized Monday, the fourth Monday, was Christmas in December. So I said, well, obviously I'm not going to give a talk then. And I was like, darn, I would really like to give a talk on Christmas. Mm-hmm. Not because I have any idea what I would talk about, but just so I could figure out, what would I talk about if I gave a talk on Christmas? But I knew the, you know, campus would be closed, and we don't do that. So, okay. So I knew in advance, well, there's this kind of list. Also, I don't have to give a talk in December. Don't get to, and don't have to. Both. And then, there was something else that says, well, you know, you can put it down even beyond December if you want. I was like, I guess I can. And so, I did. Still wondering, well, what's that about? And, you know, part of me could say it was because I gave a talk and I wasn't happy and I said, I just need to stop and start over. But actually, I felt pretty good about my November talk. So that was nice not to have that be a reason. You know, like, well, there wasn't this going on. But there's this general, you know, I get tired of myself. I imagine we all do. Like, So let me just put that aspect of myself down and see what it's about, you know. And to see, well, is there something else? Maybe I've gotten stuck in a rut and I don't know. And really, what occurred to me, once I made the decision and made it known, and it was so, like within the next few days, maybe the week, what occurred to me was like, it was just about disrupting the pattern. I was like, oh, that's what this is about. Just to see what it's like to disrupt the pattern. So, like, there could have been that energy of something going for a while. You break the pattern, you let the energy drop. It might pick up the same way it was before. It might pick up anew, I don't know. But it seemed good just to drop the pattern. Disrupt the pattern. And then just wonder, well, what is it now? And so being tapped, hey, you want to do this again? It's like, well, okay, sure. I don't know if I'm picking up the same pattern or a new pattern emerges. That's the wondering and curiosity going forward. So, yeah, it's nice to, just disrupt the pattern. I enjoy doing that. And there's actually something pretty central to our practice about that. Or that's an essential component of our practice. I mean, meditation itself is disrupting the pattern. You go about your daily doings and beings. The stimulus response things we get caught in, and then you say, I'm going to, for a half an hour, for an hour, for however long, I'm going to do nothing. So it's a pretty radical pattern disruption. And then we enter back into our patterns, having done that, and they flow along differently somehow. Slightly, maybe sometimes in larger ways, but just disrupting the pattern is beneficial. And then that, to me, calls to mind a deeper... It seems to be related to pattern disruption, but it's some kind of a deeper or a broader spirit of Zen practice, which is deconstruction. You know, not only disrupt the pattern, and you're not just putting things on hold. You're sitting and then letting things fall apart or taking them apart. Yeah, so we we intentionally take them apart. Not necessarily give us something to build, but say, take this time to just drop away. Yeah? So, I mean, it's woven throughout our tradition. So, a few koans come to mind. The first one that came to mind, I'll tell you second. Because there's one that I sent out with my little blurb about what I think I might be talking about tonight. Which, I did it because the other one, I don't know that the connection would be as obvious to deconstruction. And it's also a really lovely one with Zhizong. He's the master cart maker. He's said to be the person who invented the cart, the originator of the cart. Mm-hmm. And he built hundreds of carts. And the koan says, you know, grab a cart, take off both wheels, remove the axle, take the whole thing completely apart. What becomes vividly clear? Yeah. So tear it apart. I just see this array of a cart spread out there. Then look at it. What is vividly clear? Vividly apparent. And the other koan that had shown up, come to meet me earlier on, was just this one where a teacher says, mind is not Buddha, wisdom is not the way. And this is in the Gateless Gateway collection. And it comes after a series, well, not a series, but before that, there's some questions, what is Buddha, and various responses. But if you look at this particular stream, one person asks, what is Buddha? And the teacher responds, this very mind is Buddha. Another person asks later, what is Buddha? This, he's asking actually the same teacher. The teacher says, not mind, not Buddha. Yeah? Then you have this one that comes later, says, mind is not Buddha, wisdom is not the way. And what this speaks to is, you know, the deconstruction of, you know, any kind of path we formulate, any concept we build, any construct we construct, to take it apart. So you visited, mind is Buddha, not mind, not Buddha. But we might even, you know, there's already the play of the same teacher saying two different things. He's saying, don't even rely on what I said, take that apart. But then we have this general idea of wisdom, that'll help, follow wisdom. And here he's saying, wisdom's not the way. Don't even try to be wise. Don't follow that. Take it apart, yeah? So, then I thought, well, not then, it wasn't like that, a series of things. Woven into all this, words from Bodhidharma, you know, this four-line stanza about what is Zen. It says a special mind-to-mind transmission outside of the scriptures or the teachings, not dependent upon words and letters, directly perceiving your true nature and becoming a Buddha. So that part of, it's outside of the words and the scriptures and not dependent on words and letters, outside of the teachings. It kind of has that same quality of, we'll get beyond the concepts and the constructions. It gets misunderstood in my opinion and observation to mean that we're anti-concept and anti-construct and you should just get rid of them. And it's more, I see it as it's a course correction. Noticing our tendency to want the concept, want the recipe, to organize things in that way, we're bound to that way of being. So we have this drastic take it all apart and get rid of it. Not as replace your concept view with non-concept view, because that's a concept, but more to just pull you out of that, to get you unstuck. Then you can flow in between, yeah? So I'd say it's anti-getting stuck in concept and views. It's not anti-concept, anti-view, anti-construction, just anti-getting stuck in any of that. So the disrupting the pattern, the deconstruction helps unsticking happen. Yeah. And kind of maybe a big celebration of that spirit, I find it in the Heart Sutra. You know, the Heart Sutra, many facets and angles and levels that you can meet it on. So this is just one of them. And it's kind of grounded in the history of it. And it has to do with that whole section of know this, know that, know, all those undoings, those deconstructings. So historically, at the time when the Heart Sutra came about, Buddhism had been around for a while, and people had developed ideas and concepts and methods of, well, this is how we teach. You know, different schools had different things that they prized or were central to them. And all those no's are undoing what people have established. And again, and I'll come to it, it's not to get rid of them, but just to keep us from getting stuck in thinking we've figured it out. Yeah. Like there's this group called the Sarvastivadins who talked about our senses and their functioning and what they perceive, what they, you know, the eye and the color. No eye, no ear, no nose, and we have no color, no sound, no taste and smell and all that. They were teaching the senses are how we know all this. And so the Heart Sutra says, let's wipe that away. So while they're saying the eye and the color it perceives is where we find awakening, the Heart Sutra says, no eye, no color, take it out. Then there's this other thing you may have heard of, kind of a mouthful, the 12 links of interdependent co-arising. Yeah. I've encountered it mainly in Tibetan Buddhism, but you can look it up, it's there. But this 12 link thing that it starts with ignorance and it ends with death, old age and death. So we have the Heart Sutra saying no ignorance, and eventually says no old age and death, but it also says no ending of ignorance and no ending of old age and death. So the Heart Sutra starts to undo itself. It's like, let's wipe away the 12 links, but also let them exist eternally, that there is no wiping away of it. So it starts to, you know, pull the ground out from beneath everything. From underneath everything. And then I think my favorite is that the Heart Sutra wipes away the Four Noble Truths. You know, the Four Noble Truths are basically there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path to realize this. The Heart Sutra says, no suffering, cause of suffering, cessation, path. Wipes it away. So I love that. What I also love is that this teaching was valued enough, even though it's known that it came centuries after the time of the historical Buddha, they call it a sutra. And the sutra officially should be something that the Buddha taught. Yeah. So they call this a sutra, and it's said to contain the core teachings of Buddhism. And here, in this thing, that's why it's called the Heart Sutra, heart as in the pith, the core. So here in the core of the teachings, it's wiping away the foundations of Buddhism. Great. But again, not as a means of saying get rid of that stuff. It's more to me saying, as with the words from Bodhidharma, it's valuable to have these teachings and these words and guidance from ancestors. So use them, let them support you and help you, but don't let them be the foundation upon which your awakening is built. You must go beneath them and find your own awakening. Don't rely on somebody else's awakening and ride on that person's coattails. Find yours, let it meet you, let it find you, yeah? And so what I really see here is it's unsticking us from the formulations so that we can drop into the space beneath, which is where the formulations emanate from. And then we can know them ourselves. So we might find the exact same Four Noble Truths, but they're coming from within. They're coming organically, rather than something we're upholding. Yeah? It's like, if you look at it, if we break it up into a timeline, Siddhartha, before he was the Buddha, there was no such thing as the Four Noble Truths. He awakened. And the Four Noble Truths came about afterward, as far as the teaching. So he wasn't even relying upon them. But that upon which he was relying, or that he allowed his awakening, is present in what informed the well, what can I say about this? Let's talk about these Four Noble Truths. But the source of it all was there before it was spoken, before it was grasped, it was there. I think that's really the invitation here, is to get beneath and let it arise anew and see the awakening, see the truth of it directly for yourself. So that thing Bodhidharma says about, well, becoming a Buddha, that's what it's about. Back to the source. That's not really what I want to talk about tonight. That's the prelude. It's related, but I want to talk. You know, the central thing that I want to explore is what I see as the most pervasive and persistent and enduring concept that we have, which is of ourself, of who we are. And what do we do about deconstructing that? And that's what I think, you know, the practices I've spoken of are pointing to is, you know, set aside those teachings and what about what you yourself are constructing and depending upon all the time, this fiction that you've created and called it you, yeah? So in addition to that pattern disruption of meditation, it's really a chance, as you well know, to notice all these constructs and things you've built and called yourself or your patterns and your tendencies and to see them and not do anything about them except observe and notice what it's like to have them there and to feel the weight of them or the joy of them, whatever it might be, yeah? All these ways of being that we each encompass and embody. As I was thinking about it, bzzz came to mind. It's like these buzzing bees, the way we be buzz. I thought, oh, that makes sense. And I think, you know, when you're first starting off a meditation practice, it can seem like that. You're sitting down and you've heard about, oh, it's peaceful. You're going to sit down and whatever. You sit down and instead it's like, oh, crap. Look at all this going on. All these thoughts, all these ways of being. Oh. And that's part of it, yeah? So time goes by and you notice maybe the does more like that. It kind of settles down and it's not this steady, constant level of buzz. But it's still a buzzing. Things start to, you know, again, settle down and get refined. So it's zzz, zzz. And notice sometimes I'm zzz. Other times I'm just zzz. Yeah. Then beneath the buzzing, over time, I think we encounter or we learn how, not learn how, encounter and learn how to hum. Or realize we're always actually humming before we buzz. Just that through line of our being that we find that's always present. It's not necessarily active and jumping around. It's always there. And right? So the hum has more of a grounding sense. And that's what we can discover as we notice these constructions and things that we've built. Our buzzings and our hummins. Hummins. Buzzins and hummins. Buzzes and hummings. And that's beneficial, yeah? To get to that place of the hum, and it can kind of be this steady hum flowing beneath everything and relaxing, not as energetic as those buzzings. We might be able to choose how we buzz from place to place a little better, or we're not going to buzz like that at all anymore, right? And I think a lot of the practices that we engage in, initially I'll say are geared towards refining the hum and adjusting the buzz, yeah? But I'd say more, it's our human tendency is to just bring our practice to that level of things, which is kind of an endless loop. You hum and you buzz, you hum and you buzz. You can go on the rest of your life refining those and fine-tuning them, getting to where you're satisfied and it feels good, and it's a beneficial project. But there's more to discover and realize than that. And for me, what the image that came to mind was what I just did. And the inhalation that happens that allows you to buzz and that allows you to hum. And in the inhalation, you can't buzz or hum. There's just or but in the inhalation, it's just kind of an empty space. Although you may be preparing for your hum or your buzz while you're inhaling, yeah? Sometimes not. And then you may find over time that you inhale and then you exhale and there is no hum and there is no buzz. More of an open space. Or maybe it's a and you're connecting more with the space beneath the humming and the buzzing. The space beneath the concepts or the ways of being, right? So I think our practice is good at connecting us with that space, giving us respite from all of the other ways of being. And that spacious, airy place. But there's even more to that, I think. And that's, it's the spaceless space within which the inhalation and exhalation is happening. And it's a spaceless space because you can only know it when there's breathing in and out. It's like, it's defined by the activity happening within it. And it's as spacious depending on, you know, it'll be very vast and spacious depending on how vast and spacious the activity is. So when we're just inhaling and exhaling, that space, that spaceless space, seems pretty vast. When we're buzzing and humming, it gets smaller, but it's the same space. But in between the inhale and the exhale, when there's nothing happening, you can't find anything at all. When there's no activity, that's why it's a spaceless space. It doesn't exist except in relationship to the activities happening. Now, this sounds maybe weird. highfalutin, maybe not that. Maybe esoteric, or what are you talking about? And I can see that. But as related to identity and those constructs of self, I think there's an utter practicality to connecting with that spaceless space, or the inhale and the exhale. And the utter practicality of it is to really consider, you know, in the realm of being somebody, how much of a person, or to what extent of anything at all do you need to be when you walk across a room? Yeah? You just need to be a being that knows how to walk and watch out for things so you don't trip and fall and bump into them. Just a very base level of being. But in my experience, you know, I've been playing with this more intently for the last little bit. How much time do I spend walking across the room as Andrew? Walking across the room as somebody, as that thing that I've built, and not simply walking across the room. You know, the thoughts in my head or the way I'm carrying myself, and that's me. And it's like, wow. Can I get beneath that? Can I just be somebody walking across the room? And this called to mind from retreats and elsewhere, I'm sure, but mainly at retreats, words from Sarah and Joan, where they would say, you know, at the end of the night, they might encourage us, in the morning, when you wake up, before you do anything, just stay there and notice and stay in that space before you reconstruct yourself. Just be in that spaceless space before you realize who you are and what you have to do. And hang out there as long as you can. And then go about what's next. So what's implied here, and through experience we can discover, is that, well, I would say even we might have a bit of that buzzing and humming going on in our sleep. So we haven't really truly entered a spaceless space, but for the most part, when we fall asleep, we forget who we are. All that stuff happens, right? Or unhappens. But then, so the implication is, once we build that first platform of who we are, that's kind of the platform that's there for the rest of the day, upon which all the other platforms and ways of being are built. And then we can get quite a scaffold of self built day by day, just because of that one platform. So it's good to have time before you build that first platform. And I'm suggesting to to discover ways to unbuild that first platform all throughout the day. To always be returning to the spaceless space or the in-breath, out-breath before anything is built. And see what that's like. And again, it comes down to how much of you do you actually need to be to go about doing your daily business? As I've been discovering, there's a very small percentage of the day I actually have to be who I think I am. But I can spend a lot of time upholding that who I think I am. Heading up to the office, I notice it starts with, I'm going to take a shower and I'm thinking of what clothes to wear and what I have to do. Or even if there isn't a lot to do and there's just those simple decisions to make, once I start the process, it's like this snowball effect of Andrew at the office has been constructed and just keeps building and rolling along. Starting in the shower and before I even get to the office, I'm already become Andrew in the office. When there's this whole period of time where I don't have to be Andrew at all. I need to, okay, what am I going to wear? That's good. Then just go back to what I'm doing and drop it. Driving I-25. I don't need to be Andrew in the office. I need to be a guy driving and watching out for traffic and watching out for others. I don't even have to have a name. And so, just noticing that. Noticing the habit to want to inhabit myself. And then to release it and drop down again to stay as low as I can on the building of the platform of self throughout the day. Last night I went to the store and in that kind of being nobody place, which is great. Especially because at the store they keep rearranging things. Yes. They keep moving them. And when I knew who I was and where I was going to find the chocolate, I get frustrated because the chocolate's not where it used to be, and it's supposed to be here, and I knew it was, and there I am, Andrew, looking for chocolate. Walking to the store last night, I got to be nobody, wondering, where's the chocolate? And, oh, I found it. Or my sparkly water. It's like they've changed it several weeks ago, but I keep discovering, there it is, and it's like magical. Because I don't have to be anybody. I don't have to carry this guy who knows where the water and the chocolate is. But I get to discover where the water and the chocolate is. And in the process, discover, well, who am I at this moment? And then let it go. Get beneath all the concepts. Drop below. Yeah? Again and again and again. So I invite you to... right now, or...
I have to go. Uh-huh. So I just wanted to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Can I do that?
Let's see.
So I just wondered, like, when you're Andrew in the office, and in the office, how much can you let go of Andrew in the office while you're in the act of being in the office?
It depends on the circumstance. Mm-hmm. Like the other day, I was there and weren't many people around, so responding to the email, I was Andrew in the office. Send, I'm not Andrew in the office anymore. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes, you have a conversation, I'm Andrew in the office. It's over. Yeah. It's kind of like that. And that's the other side of this is, which was where I was going, so perfect timing. Part of it is figuring out what's the minimal amount I need to actually show up. Instead of some places I might show up 120%. Other places I show up 60%. But I've constructed that. So I've got to notice, well, here I'm imposing myself and here I'm holding myself back. Let me take that apart and make myself available so that the situation, allow it to call me forth the way it needs me to show up. Mm-hmm. So that what comes up is it may need me to be there only 60%, but it's 60% 100% of the time. Because the situation is saying, this is what I need, so I rely on that 100%. But it's really allowing the situation to call me forth. So like the email or the conversation, it calls me forth as much as I need to be there, and then I can let it go. And if there's the project, well, that's another story.
Well, I find that even though that I don't even need to be there as much as I think as I need to be there, like in the middle of that conversation sometimes, sometimes, or the email, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a loosening of the clayness of, like, responding. Or an example is, like, having a bad, you know, conversation with your cell phone provider or something like that, mm-hmm. like, on the phone, going, like, how come I have this new service called Visual Voicemail that, like, writes down all the voicemail on my phone, and why I really don't want that, and how these people tell me, well, it's not even on your plan, and we've turned it off. Anyway.
Yeah.
But in the middle of that very frustrating conversation to just be this not having to be very invested. I'm just there to try to find out if this could be corrected.
Yeah.
And they seem to be trying to correct it, although it just isn't really working out. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, so there's a lot of stuff you can put into, like, getting it corrected, damn it. I'm here to get the job done.
Yeah.
And realizing that the job is not getting done. It's not getting done the way that I want it to get done. And there's a nice way of letting go of that, which is letting go of my identity, mm-hmm. of saying I'm the guy that's going to get the job.
Yeah, so crossing that threshold of being and non-being more and more, instead of going to extremes of non-being to extremes of being, is kind of this evened out being non-being that is permeable. So then you can show up and be in the middle of the thing, but also be open enough to be not in the middle of it as you, but just as the thing that's there having the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. So yeah, explore tonight when we're cleaning up, how much do you have to be you as you're grabbing a cushion and stacking it here and there? And then when somebody engages you in conversation, how much do you have to be you? That's what happened in the store last night, is I was there as nobody. Then I ran into somebody I knew. So I arose as, oh yeah, I'm the guy that knows them in that situation. And so we had our conversation and remembered, oh yeah, you're going on a trip and this and that. Then we parted and I was nobody again. But the situation called me forth to being that particular Andrew, yeah? Mm-hmm. So you can let yourself be called forth and trust things to call you forth in the appropriate measure just as much as they need you to, if you allow that, yeah? So in the end, this isn't about denying identity and concepts and constructs of self. And, you know, like I said earlier, it's not about that. It's about that becoming permeable, not getting stuck in things. And really, it's about unlimiting yourself, because, you know, if I have this idea of this is who I am and my identity, and I step into it every time, I've got these limitations. If I'm nobody at all, I'm able to be anything and everything. There's the full potential of that at any given time. Because I'm not holding on too tightly of being any particular way, but I'm willing to show up and to be called forth. So again, I can be anything and everything that's needed. Yeah. So can you. So play with this. Go into the store. Take advantage of as many opportunities as you can to be nobody. It's really nice. Especially, I think, of driving. I'm neither one of these, but you kind of have the aggressive driver or the defensive driver, right? You might identify as one of those. Mm-hmm. Well, go driving at 4:30 in the morning and decide, do you really need to be any particular kind of driver when there's no traffic? You can be no driver at all. And then when the thing arises, respond to it appropriately. And either defensively back off or aggressively get around it. And then go back to being nobody. Kind of like that. And that's like that spaceless space that gets formed by the activity within it and then disappears when there's no activity. This is its counterpart, which is the formless form coming into form, as Hakuin says. In the midst of form, it's a formless form coming into form, dropping away. So there's its partner. Spaceless space, formless form. So thanks.
Thank you.